Today's show is sponsored by Procure, maker of RosaCare cream. RosaCare is formulated with hyaluronic acid and licorice root extract to clear flushed, red, bumpy skin caused by rosacea. It's safe and effective to use on your entire body and face. Try RosaCare today and get a $3 discount on Amazon using the code 3JUNKIE. Just go to procureheals.com/junkie and use the code 3JUNKIE. That's the number 3 plus junkie, all one word, and make sure you type it in all caps. 31-year-old Erica Murray had what most people might consider your typical run-of-the-mill Facebook page. Her About section showed that she was in a relationship since June 23rd, 2000, with a man named Ray Rivera. And there are posts and photos about her work and her two kids, a 10-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter. She appeared to dote on them. She posted about a trip they took together to go apple picking, just Erica, Ray, and her two children. She posted about their holidays, what costumes her two kids wore on Halloween, how she cooked on Thanksgiving, and how they put up a Christmas tree around Christmas time. And she posted about picking up school supplies for the kids. On August 23rd, 2014, quote, "It was a good day. We got everything the kids needed for back to school. And I got awesome news about my sales at the store. Going to lay down and relax." It was clear that one of Erica's hobbies, and perhaps even how she made money, was from making crafts and then selling them online. Erica also posted quite a bit about tragedies involving children. One of her status updates read, "Some people should not be parents." On another, she posted the link to a GoFundMe campaign and wrote, "Donate to help this family. Such a tragedy. No parent should have to lose their child." Another time, she shared a photo from a local news station about a 2-year-old little girl named Latoya Brown, who was missing from West Philadelphia. But there was something that Erica's many Facebook friends didn't know and would likely never suspect just from looking at her page, something that she never posted about. And that's that she was hiding a very dark secret, a secret that would be exposed not long after she posted about that missing 2-year-old girl. You see, there were dead bodies in Erica's house, bodies that she knew about and was living with every day, even as she updated her statuses on Facebook. Today's case is one where every detail, every revelation, and every outcome sounds like it's something from a horror movie. In fact, many news articles dubbed this the House of Horrors case. But it's not from a movie. It's sadly very, very real. And I'm going to tell you about it in today's episode. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 77. Everything came to a head just after 4 p.m. on August 28th, 2014. It was an otherwise beautiful day in Blackstone, Massachusetts, a town of less than 10,000 people, about 50 miles southwest of Boston. In a quaint Blackstone neighborhood located within walking distance of the local police and fire stations, one of Erica Murray's neighbors called 911. Her 13-year-old son, who had been playing with Erica's 10-year-old son all day, had asked her for her help in soothing babies that were crying inside Erica's home. "I can't get the babies to stop crying," he told her. She would later tell reporters that she was confused as to what babies he was talking about. She had only recently met Erica, and their sons had only recently become friends. But from what she knew, Erica only had two children— her son's friend, as well as an older sister. Nevertheless, she walked over to Erica's house with the two boys. Sure enough, she heard what sounded like babies crying, and she asked Erica's son where the babies were. He led her inside the house where she saw dirt and debris everywhere. She would later say that the odor in the air was the worst thing she had ever smelled. They walked up the stairs to the second floor, which was covered in complete darkness. There were no lights on, and blankets and sheets had been placed over the windows. They followed the sounds of the crying babies, which led them into a bedroom where a small baby girl, who looked to be about 5 months old, was lying on a bed, crying. In another room next door was a 3-year-old girl who was also on a bed, also crying, and was rocking violently back and forth. Both children were covered in feces and maggots and appeared to have been abandoned. The neighbor, who would later say that she was trying not to panic, immediately called 911. "There are babies inside this house. They're covered in urine and feces," she said. When police officers arrived, they were shocked at the condition of the house. It was in complete disarray, filled with trash, dirty diapers, and human and animal feces throughout. There were flies, maggots, and fleas everywhere, and the odor in the home was overwhelming. The neighbor left as more officers arrived at the home. She said she was scared to death and in shock over the conditions of the 2 young children and of the home. When she got outside, Erica was there. She confronted her and asked what she was thinking, leaving her kids alone like that. Erica responded that she didn't know why she was so upset. She had only left them there for a few hours. The Department of Children and Family Services removed the 2 young children, along with Erica's 2 older children, from the home. An investigator who spoke with reporters said the 2 younger children were showing signs of severe neglect. But if Erica was upset that the children had been taken away, she wasn't outwardly showing it. According to reports, after they had been removed, Erica asked investigators if they knew where her cat was. She told them that he was an inside cat, that he had somehow gotten out of the house, and she was afraid that he wouldn't make it through the night. Erica was arrested and charged with 2 counts of reckless endangerment of a child. After a court hearing, she was released on her own recognizance and reportedly went to stay with family members, who would later say that she didn't tell them what had just happened. Instead, she told them that her boyfriend Ray had been busted for running a marijuana business out of their home, and that her 2 children, the 13 and 10-year-olds, had been temporarily taken by the state. She didn't tell them about the 2 younger children. It would turn out that she never had. She had been keeping those children a secret from everyone. But those children weren't the only secret that Erica was keeping from everyone she knew. Her other, bigger secret was about to come to light. But Erica didn't seem worried. In fact, on August 29th, just one day after the police removed her children from her home, she posted on Facebook lyrics from an Iggy Azalea song, quote, "I'm so fancy." 2 weeks later, on September 10th, 2014, police officers returned to Erica's house to execute a search warrant. They were still trying to figure everything out, and they were looking for any identifying paperwork that could confirm whether or not all 4 children were Erica's. One officer went upstairs and was looking around in one of the bedrooms. He opened a closet that had been blocked by a bed and was stunned at what he found. There, inside the closet, were the skeletal remains of a deceased baby. The baby was unclothed and still had the umbilical cord attached to the placenta. The medical examiner was called to the home, and officers obtained another search warrant so they could continue to thoroughly search the house. Meanwhile, Erica had been brought into the police station, and she agreed to speak with investigators. She told them that yes, all 4 children were hers, including the 2 younger children that had been removed from the home, the 3-year-old and the 5-month-old. She listed their names and birth dates and said her boyfriend Ray was the father of all 4, and that they were all on his insurance as dependents. But just a few minutes later, she said that Ray actually didn't know about the 2 younger kids, and that her older 2 kids didn't know about them either. She said she had hid the pregnancies by wearing loose clothes, and that when she gave birth to them in secret, at home, in their bathroom, while the rest of the family was sleeping. Whenever Ray or the older kids would see them, she would say that she was babysitting, that they were actually the children of a woman she had made up, named Michelle. She said she had even created a fake Facebook page for Michelle, which included a photo of herself wearing a wig and glasses. She said she was scared and nervous to tell them the truth. She told them that Ray had said that he didn't want any more kids, that he had told her that plenty of times. When he learned about everything a couple weeks ago, when the kids were removed from the home, she said he was really upset. "Did Ray think you were babysitting?" Trooper Christopher Murphy asked. "I don't know," she replied. "Do you think it's strange?" he asked her. "Yeah, but I got into it, and I just didn't know how to get out of it," she said. Trooper Murphy asked her if there were any other children she gave birth to like that, any miscarriages, and she said no. He told her they went through her house, that it's very unsanitary, with rodents and fleas. Erica just said, "Yeah." The investigators asked her what she thinks is going on and why she's in trouble. Erica said because she didn't tell anybody about the youngest two and because the house was bad. She said it had been months since she cleaned the second floor, but that she would clean the downstairs occasionally. She said she was never an overly neat person. Then Trooper Murphy confronted her about the skeletal remains of a child they found in the closet. Erica said she has no idea and that the child wasn't hers. "Did you give birth in a closet at any time?" he asked her. She said, "No, I haven't been in the closets in a long time." "So if we did a DNA test on that child, it's not going to come back to you?" he asked. "No," she replied. But Trooper Murphy continued pressing her. He finally asked her, "Something must have happened, right?" And Erica said, "Yeah, it just wasn't born alive." She said it was normal. It just wasn't alive. She said it came out and it was blue and wasn't breathing. So she wrapped the baby in a towel and hid it in a closet. Trooper Murphy asked her what she was planning on doing after putting it in the closet, and she said she doesn't know. She just panicked. Trooper Murphy asked if there was anything else in there, and Erica said no. "I just want you to be honest with me. If there's any other children, it would be helpful for you to tell me," he said. Erica repeated her answer, "No." Another investigator told her that he didn't believe her, that she's telling them an unbelievable story. She told them that she panicked, that she hadn't felt a heartbeat. "I just wasn't thinking," she said. The investigators told her that not thinking isn't a good answer. They asked her if she was afraid of something, and she said she was afraid because she didn't tell anyone, that no one knew. She said she was being 100% truthful with them. She was then asked, "You don't suffer from any mental illness or anything like that?" And Erica responded, "Not that I know of." But back at Erica's house, the police were continuing their search. Once they obtained the additional search warrant, investigators continued searching the house. In the same closet where they found the remains of the baby, they found a trash bag with a dead dog inside. As they continued through the closet, towards the back of the closet, they made another gruesome discovery. They found the skeletal remains of a second baby. This one was wearing a diaper and was fully clothed. In another closet, in another bedroom of the house, they found the skeletal remains of a third deceased baby, also wearing a diaper and also fully clothed. A deceased cat was also recovered from the home. By this time, neighbors in the small town had gathered outside their homes and watched as investigators wearing protective hazmat gear went in and out of the house, back and forth to two blue tents they had set up outside. Rumors had started swirling on the quiet residential street about the awful living conditions the children had been living in. Worcester District Attorney Joseph Early Jr. spoke to reporters outside.
"Today at 23 St. Paul Road in Blackstone, Massachusetts, the remnants of three infants have been found in the residence. Right now, the investigation is still in its early stages. The house is in squalor. The house has been condemned. The State Police Crime Scene Services, Dr. Niels, the medical examiner is out here. Blackstone Police are still involved in an ongoing and active investigation. What I can tell you at this point is that we're going to be here through the night. We're going to be here through the next couple of days. With regards to the investigation, we do not have the genders of the infants yet. We don't have the manner and cause of death. But what we do know is that we have three infants that have been found deceased at this residence. Thank you very much.
Do you know where the parents are right now?
We have to ascertain who was in the house, who was living at the house, what was the time and cause of death, who was in the house. When we ascertain the time of death, we don't know yet who was living in the house at the time of death. These are all things that we're going to pursue throughout the course of the investigation.
After the discovery of the additional remains, investigators confronted Erica yet again. They told her they had found two more babies and asked if she forgot about them when talking to them earlier. And she said, "I didn't even think about that." She said she had those two babies in secret too, in her bathtub, and that none of them were alive when they were born. But a little later, she said one was alive for about a week before he or she died. She said she noticed that the baby was in distress, but she didn't call 911 because she panicked. "Why did you put the baby in the closet?" she was asked. "I don't know. I panicked," she said. Erica was placed under arrest and charged with fetal death concealment, witness intimidation, animal cruelty, and permitting substantial injury to a child. She pleaded not guilty and was held on $1 million cash bond. In a statement, the Department of Children and Family Services said that the agency never had an open case with the family. They acknowledged receiving a report of abuse or neglect back in 2007, but they said it was unsupported and that a case was never opened. Erica's boyfriend, Ray Rivera, was also arrested and facing charges for growing marijuana in their basement. He reportedly said he had no idea about the three deceased babies and the two younger children living in his house. We'll get into what happens next, including more charges, another arrest in the case, and of course, the trial testimony, right after this quick break from today's sponsor. Support for today's show comes from Pet Relief. Pet Relief makes all-natural, USDA-certified organic CBD products for pets using full-spectrum CBD hemp oil that is grown and extracted in Colorado. And with a wide variety of products, they have something to assist a range of ailments, such as hip and joint pain, inflammation, situational anxiety, and more. They also offer oils for both cats and dogs that are made with only two ingredients: full-spectrum CBD hemp oil and organic coconut oil. And their supplements are all handmade and baked with human-grade organic ingredients that have been sourced from farms across the United States. Not to mention, all of their products are third-party tested in an effort to be completely transparent. I've been using Pet Relief for my dog, Porky, for a few weeks now. Porky is a Maltese Yorkie mix. You may have seen him on Instagram. And he's quite an anxious and hyper dog, even at 9 years old. We started giving him hemp oil to help with his anxiety, and we have really noticed a difference, especially this past week with the 4th of July fireworks. Head on over to PetRelief.com and enter the promo code JUNKIE to get 10% off your order. That's PetRelief, PetRelief.com, offer code JUNKIE. Before Erica's trial was set to begin, her attorney, Keith Halpern, spoke to reporters about Erica and about the two younger children who had initially been found in the home. He said he had spent a lot of time talking with his client and that he believes she suffers from some sort of mental disorder. He said her perceptions don't match reality, that she didn't think she was neglecting the two younger children and didn't think her home was uninhabitable. He told reporters that Erica and Ray had been together since high school and that she had her first baby when she was just 18. After having their second child a few years later, Ray told her he didn't want any more. But 3 years ago, Erica secretly gave birth to a third child, which Halpern said made her life more isolated. And about 2.5 years after that, she secretly had another one. Halpern said she was terrified that Ray would find out about them, and so she hid them upstairs and told him and the older children that she was just babysitting. Quote, "Try to imagine the kind of fear and sort of loss of control over your life that would lead to a woman giving birth to a child alone on the floor of her bathroom. That's what she was going through." He said the terror she felt controlled her and that she couldn't figure out a way out of it. When asked if domestic violence was a factor, he said he really doesn't know. But although she kept them a secret, he said she loved them and spent endless amounts of time with them. Quote, "As hard as this is to fathom, given the allegations, she is completely attached to these children, including the two younger children." As for the three deceased babies, he said he was optimistic that forensic testing would show that they weren't born alive, and therefore his client couldn't have harmed or killed them. But prosecutors disagreed and told the court in a pre-trial hearing that two out of the three deceased babies had been born alive and that they were alive for, quote, some period of time. They noted that the two had been wearing diapers and were dressed in onesies. And so on December 29th, 2014, a grand jury indicted Erica on additional charges: 2 counts of murder, 1 count of fetal death concealment, and 2 counts of assault and battery. Erica pleaded not guilty at her arraignment. The prosecutor described what officers found in the closets of the home and argued that Erica should not be granted bail.
The evidence before the grand jury has suggested, Your Honor, that all of the children given birth to by the defendant were placed in this trash-filled bedroom and literally isolated in their own home. This bedroom was filled with trash. There was feces smeared upon the walls of the bedroom. And it appears that the children were neither nourished, cared for, or literally brought out of that bedroom into the rest of the house or the rest of the outside world. We would suggest that based on the nature and circumstances of the case, based upon the fact that the defendant is now facing 2 murder indictments, that she should be held without bail during the pendency of this case.
The judge agreed and ordered her held without bail, based on the seriousness of the allegations, he said. He asked if there were any requests for a competency evaluation on either side at this time, and both sides said no. Erica's boyfriend, Ray, who was facing marijuana charges unrelated to Erica's case, told reporters that he was a crumbling man. In an interview outside of the courthouse after a hearing on his charges, he said he didn't learn about the dead babies or the existence of the 5-month-old until police told him. He said he knew about the 3-year-old, but said Erica had told him she was babysitting. He said Erica had also told the older kids to tell him that she was babysitting. He said he had spent 99% of his time in the basement of the house and that he wasn't allowed upstairs. He started crying when talking about the 2 younger children he never knew about, saying that he hadn't even seen a picture of them. After their older kids were taken away on August 28th, he said Erica sent him a text message and lied to him. She told him that their house had been foreclosed on, and since she couldn't find a new place for them to live, the state had taken the kids into custody. He said he later picked her up on the side of the road and stayed with her at her parents' house. "I'm crumbling. I'm a crumbling man," he said. But just months later, Ray was charged in the case. Prosecutors said he did nothing to alleviate the dangerous conditions in the home. He was facing several charges, including 2 counts of assault and battery on a child, causing substantial bodily injury. Erica's trial started in June 2019, just a few weeks ago as of this recording. Instead of facing a jury, Erica and her defense team opted for a bench trial, meaning they wanted to try the case in front of a judge instead. In his opening statement, Assistant District Attorney Christopher Hodgins told a judge that this is a case about the children.
Children. This is a case about children. Children who lived under the same roof, but children who lived in vastly different worlds. These worlds were created by the defendant, Erica Murray. It was a world of light, which is a world of darkness. It was a world of kindness versus a world of cruelty. It was a world of the wanted versus a world of the unwanted. It was a world of life versus a world of death. These worlds collided quite by accident on the afternoon of August 28, 2014. It was on that day that a veil of secrecy was lifted from the home of Erica Murray.
He said Erica was the mother of seven children, but that five of those seven children were kept in absolute secret from the world until that day in August. He described how the case came to be, how Erica's neighbor had discovered the two younger children covered in feces inside the home. He said after the Department of Children and Family Services took custody of them, it was learned that the two children had never seen the light of day, had never seen a doctor, and had never been immunized for anything. As a result of their confinement in that house, he said both of them had impaired cognitive and physical development. He said the three-year-old did not appear to have the ability to hold her own weight and stand. Her muscles weren't strong enough to support her. When in a seated position, she would just flop over. He said she had hip dysplasia and also appeared to show some evidence of autism. He said the five-month-old barely made any sounds and didn't yet have the ability to bring her hands together to hold something. Her muscles were not developed enough. But the two older children, he said, were known to the world. They were born in a hospital, had seen physicians, went to school, and had other immunizations. But the conditions in the house posed a grave risk of serious injury, and so they were removed from the home too. He said evidence will show that Erica created two different worlds for her children, a world for the wanted and a world for the unwanted. He concluded by saying that she needlessly allowed her children to suffer in that home and that she caused the death of two of those babies. In his opening statement, Erica's attorney, Keith Halpern, acknowledged that everyone involved in the case dealt with real challenges, given what they learned about the condition of the home and of the way the children were raised. He said the bizarre and disturbing facts made it difficult for anyone dealing with it to deal with it objectively. He said the search warrant application alleged probable cause that Erica had kidnapped the children and was involved in child trafficking. He alleged that investigators knew that wasn't true, that they knew Erica had no money and knew that she didn't know how to drive a car. He then went through the charges and said that each one involves both mental illness and underlying substantive facts. Regarding the reckless endangerment charges concerning the two older children, the 13-year-old and 10-year-old, he said that requires proof of subjective state of mind. He told the judge that she will hear evidence regarding whether Erica's mental state impaired her ability to appreciate how bad that house was and the risk it created for not just the two older kids, but for herself, her boyfriend, and anyone else. Did it create a substantial risk of death or permanent disfigurement, he asked. There's no question the evidence will establish that there were risks in living in a house like that, but he said those risks never materialized. The older children had no sickness, no infection, no diseases, and no history that they ever had. He said that's not dismissing or minimizing how bad the house was, but it's a testament to how difficult it is to be injured by simply living in squalor. As for the assault and battery causing substantial injury charges concerning the two younger children, he said those counts are based on wanton and reckless conduct. It's a specific intent crime that requires proof of subjective knowledge. He said the Commonwealth has a duty to show that Erica understood and appreciated those circumstances and the way in which those circumstances were causing substantial injury to the children. Not only that, he said there's a mental illness factor to these counts too, that the Commonwealth has a burden to satisfy. Did she understand that her conduct was causing substantial injury? He asked. Furthermore, did the children suffer substantial injury? He told the judge that she'll be hearing from two doctors that the prosecution will call. Both of them specialize in treatment of children who have been abused and neglected. He said their opinions and conclusions were motivated and influenced by the very nature of that specialty. He told the judge that the three-year-old's symptoms were consistent with autism, not from conditions in the home. 3 months after being removed from the home, he said the girl's foster mother had asked for her to be evaluated for autism, and sure enough, she was diagnosed with it. He said the five-month-old had suffered no injury at all, not as defined under the statute, that her condition was largely normal. Any minor problems she had were resolved quickly. Halpern then addressed the murder charges and said Erica's state of mind matters. He said her mental illness isn't being brought into this case based on an argument that she lacks criminal responsibility, that she did things for which she was not criminally responsible, but it explains what in fact she did and why, and how behaviors that might otherwise look like the conduct of somebody covering up a crime, in her case, that's not what it was about. It was about how sick she was. He said there's also a more fundamental defense to the charge of murder, and that is that the evidence is not sufficient to establish that a homicide ever even occurred. He said that one of the Commonwealth's witnesses is a doctor from the medical examiner's office, who says that two of the babies were born alive. But he said his opinion is not based on science, but on the fact that the two babies were dressed and the other one wasn't. That's not science, he said. He said another doctor for the Commonwealth will say that one of the three babies was born alive, based on something called a neonatal tooth line, more about that later, but that it was an unproved, untested, and unsupported theory. He said Erica acknowledged that one baby was born alive and had told the police that it died shortly after through no cause of her own. It just died. He said no evidence will undercut that statement. And no evidence will prove that Erica did anything wrong or criminal that caused the death of any child. He noted that the challenge of this case is to focus on the evidence without being pushed to unsupported conclusions because of how upsetting the story is. The Commonwealth's first witness was Betsy Brown, Erica's neighbor who first discovered the two younger kids when she went to Erica's house on August 28th. She testified that Erica's house was always disheveled from the outside. The curtains were always closed, and there was always a disturbing odor coming from the home. She recalled thinking when she first went into the house that day that the smell was the worst thing she had ever smelled, and she could clearly hear the children in distress, crying and screaming. The prosecution displayed photos of the five-month-old and three-year-old. Betsy said they had feces up their backs and that it was everywhere. She recalled even taking off her shirt so she could try and clean them off because there was nothing there that was clean that she could use. She said the house was infested with bugs, there was trash everywhere, and dirty diapers. Blackstone's acting police chief, Gregory Gilmore, further described the condition of the house. He said that after just 15 minutes there, investigators were covered in bugs. Quote, "The investigators began to notice bugs or flying insects. Fleas began to collect on our clothing." He said there was concern about their health, and so they eventually went outside. He described framed photographs as being on the wall, but said they only showed Erica's two oldest children. In the basement, he said he found a dog with mangy, matted fur. Chief Gilmore was also in the interview room with Erica and said she told them that she was embarrassed to have the two youngest children and that she couldn't afford them. William Walsh, chairman of Blackstone's Board of Health, testified that when he went to the home on August 28th, the odor was sickening and just indescribable. He said when he went upstairs to where one of the children was, there was feces on the wall and on the bed. He also saw a dead dog. He said no human could live in that house. It was so bad that it had to be torn down. They couldn't even get a company that cleans up bloody crime scenes to clean it. It was too much for them, they told him. On cross-examination, he acknowledged that there was running water and electricity in the house. He also described an encounter he had with Erica when he saw her outside after he had completed his inspection. He told her, "I don't know how you can live here." He said she admitted that it was a little dirty and that she needs to clean it up. Kevin Sullivan, a Blackstone Regional Animal Control officer, testified about a bloodhound he found in a crate in the basement of Erica's home. He described the dog as thin, with large areas of fur missing. The dog had fleas, and his eyes were sunken in. He took that dog and a cat that was also at the home to the shelter. He said the cat was treated for fleas and parasites, and the dog was treated for a full body infection. Both were adopted out to other families. Employees with the Department of Children and Family Services testified about Erica's reaction when they removed the kids from the home. Walter McLean, a social worker with the organization, said that when he told Erica that he was going to have to take the children, she said okay. He said she had a flat affect and that it didn't seem to faze her one way or another. Catherine Francy, an investigator with the organization, recalled meeting with Erica and Ray on September 3rd, days after the children had been removed. She, too, described Erica as having a flat affect, while Ray, on the other hand, was sobbing. But, she said, neither one asked her any questions about how the kids were doing or when they could see them. Dr. Peter Sell is a pediatrician who works with child abuse patients and who treated the 5-month-old and 3-year-olds. He testified about their conditions. He said the 5-month-old always wanted to lay flat on her back and wouldn't kick around or roll over. The back of her head was nearly flat. As for the 3-year-old, he said she was pale, lacked muscle tone, and that his first impression was that she was cowering. She wouldn't make eye contact with him, wouldn't verbally communicate with him, and wasn't acting how he expected a 3-year-old normally would. He said it was consistent with childhood neglect, although he acknowledged that she was later diagnosed with autism too. He told the judge that he saw the 3-year-old again 10 months after she went to live with the foster family. He said she can now walk and was engaging with him, although she still has some delays. On cross-examination, Dr. Sell acknowledged that all the symptoms he talked about regarding the 3-year-old could be due to autism. But when Halpern remarked that rocking back and forth was a textbook symptom of autism, Dr. Sell replied that it's also a textbook symptom of neglect and childhood trauma. Halpern pressed Dr. Sell on his initial notes where he diagnosed her condition as due to profound neglect. Dr. Sell admitted that his assessment was based on information that the Department of Child and Family Services had given him. On redirect, however, Dr. Sell said that neglect can make autism worse. Massachusetts State Trooper Sean Murphy interviewed Erica at the Northbridge Police Department in September of 2014. She was not under arrest at the time of that initial interview. That audio recording was played for the judge. And some additional highlights from that interview are as follows. Erica told them that the two younger children don't have birth records and that they never left the home, let alone went to see a doctor. When asked if there was a reason why she never took them, she said, "No, not really." She herself hadn't been to a doctor in 10 years since having her 10-year-old son. She said the older kids did have a pediatrician they went to. One of the officers told her that he's in disbelief that she's had two children in the house who had never seen a doctor, who never apparently got sick. And she said, "I've gotten really lucky. My kids were pretty happy babies, all of them." In the interview, she tells the officers that she hasn't seen Ray since the day the kids were taken away. She told them that they decided to just work on themselves and that she hasn't talked to him since. The investigators don't appear to believe that Ray never heard the younger kids crying. They asked her if he was deaf, and she said no. But she said Ray was gone a lot. He worked at Staples from 8:30 in the morning till 8 at night. And then on nights and weekends, he would usually stay downstairs. She told them that Ray bought the groceries, paid the bills, and bought the older kids' clothes, but that he never gave her any money. So she sold her crafts along with repurposed furniture so she could buy formula for the younger kids. She admitted to leaving the younger kids alone at home when she walked to the store. When asked how she cut the umbilical cords on the babies, she said she did it with scissors. At one point, she told the officers that no one ever came to the house, including members of her own family. The older kids had friends, but they would always go over to their friends' houses, never the other way around. When asked if her older kids were sleeping in their rooms when she put the deceased babies into their closets, she said yeah, but she also said that they would sleep on the couch sometimes. One of the investigators asked her what her plan was for the two younger kids, and she said she didn't have one, that she just took it day by day. At one point, Erica told the investigators that Ray was the one who did the laundry. When asked then who did the baby's laundry, she said no one. Regarding the deceased infants, she said that no one ever knew that she was pregnant with them. She carried all three babies for about 9 months without ever seeing a doctor and never taking any vitamins. When asked if she had ever thought about having an abortion, she said she had thought about it, but that she didn't know how she would get there to do it and didn't have health insurance. She was asked how Ray would feel if he had found out that she was pregnant again, and she said mad, really, really mad. She told the officers that she wasn't sure what gender the deceased babies were, but she thinks that one of them may have been a girl. Erica told them that one of the deceased babies, the first one, was born alive, that it was alive for a little while, perhaps for a week, before she died. She said she had found the baby on her back in the pack and play and that she was blue, but she said she was pretty sure the others were not born alive. As for notifying someone about what had happened, she said no, that no one knew about it. And as for trying to revive the baby, she said she didn't because she panicked. She said she threw all the remnants from the birth into the trash, but when asked if she had ever thought about putting the babies in the trash, she said no, she wouldn't do that. The medical examiner who conducted the autopsies of the three deceased babies testified that he was unable to determine causes of death due to how decomposed the bodies were. He was also unable to tell whether the babies had been born alive or whether they were stillborn. He said he didn't find any evidence of trauma on the bones. But, he said, he did testify in front of the grand jury that one of the babies had been born alive. To do that, he said he had consulted with a forensic anthropologist who also testified that he had found what's known as a neonatal line on one of the baby's teeth. He said there's research that goes back to the early 20th century about how those lines only develop on babies who are born alive. On cross-examination, Halpern grilled the anthropologist on this, asking him to name one study that shows that neonatal lines never occur on stillborn babies, and he said he couldn't. The prosecution's last witness was Dr. Heather Forkey, who had also examined the 3-year-old and 5-month-old. Dr. Forkey said she agreed with Dr. Sell that the 3-year-old wasn't acting the way a normal 3-year-old would. She said the girl had shut herself down and would close her body up, and she said that kids who are exposed to a constant threat will often try to become as small as possible. As for whether autism could explain the girl's behavior, she said it could not be explained by autism alone, that severe neglect was also a likely factor. Her muscles felt like dough, she said, like they hadn't been used. She said the girl did make some crying noises, but that they were very quiet. They were very concerned that she had experienced a profound amount of neglect, and they wanted to admit her to the hospital right away. She was malnourished and wasn't getting enough vitamin D. She testified that an ear, nose, and throat doctor was called in to remove the girl's earwax from her ear, and that once they did, they found a maggot in the wax. As for the five-month-old, Dr. Forkey said that she wasn't moving like a normal five-month-old either, that she was shutting down too. They were concerned that she had also been exposed to severe neglect. After Dr. Forkey's testimony, the prosecution then rested their case. But before the defense got started on their case, they argued in front of the judge for the charges to be thrown out, arguing that the Commonwealth hadn't proved their case. As for the two assault and battery charges relating to the three-year-old and five-month-old, Keith Halpern argued that it's impossible to determine which problems may have been caused by neglect and which problems may have been caused by autism. Quote, there's insufficient evidence as to the portion of the indictment that alleges substantial personal injury. And as for the two murder charges for two of the deceased babies, Halpern said that there was no evidence presented that showed that more than one baby was born alive. And that one baby, he said, was what Erica had admitted to when she said she came into the room and the baby wasn't breathing. It was blue, and she panicked. As for her not calling for help then, he said the Commonwealth has a burden to prove that calling for help would have made a difference, and they didn't. He said there's no evidence to establish that a homicide occurred. Quote, you have dead bodies and speculation that she probably did something, but that's just speculation. He said you can't base a murder conviction on what probably would have happened because you just don't know. After a brief break, the judge agreed partly with the defense. She threw out one of the two murder charges against Erica, but kept the rest. She stated that the Commonwealth never presented evidence that proved that that baby was ever born, and that you can only cause the death where the victim was alive. The defense called numerous doctors and experts to the stand. One of them was Dr. Amos Grunebaum, a specialist in maternal-fetal medicine. Dr. Grunebaum testified that he had done extensive research on home births versus hospital births. He said the term fetal death is when the fetus dies before it's been born. This is what happens with a stillborn. Neonatal death is when the infant dies within 28 days of birth. Dr. Grunebaum told the judge that there's an increased risk of a stillbirth with home births, that they aren't monitored as closely as in the hospital, and so it has been shown to statistically increase the risk. And with an unassisted home birth, the chances of a stillborn increase 10 times. He said there's also an increased risk of neonatal deaths. He told the judge about something called sudden unexpected postnatal collapse, which is when a healthy newborn dies within a week of being born with no warning signs. Dr. Grunebaum also told the judge that when a baby is stillborn, they ask the mother whether she wants to hold and even dress the baby, which he said can sometimes be helpful in their healing process. Kristen Hartnett McCann is an anthropologist who has assisted television shows like Bones and CSI. She testified that she examined the remains of the deceased babies and concluded that it wasn't possible to determine whether the babies were alive. She said she could, however, estimate that they were at 38 to 40 weeks fetal age. Hartnett McCann also testified about neonatal lines. She said there is a general agreement that a live birth can have a neonatal line, but she said using them to prove a live birth is not reliable. Dr. Frank DiCataldo was called to the stand to testify about Erica's mental health. Dr. DiCataldo told the judge that he's a clinical psychologist and a professor of psychology at Roger Williams College. He said he met with Erica twice. He interviewed her and put her through testing. He said her IQ score was lower than 86% of people her age, that her verbal abilities were average, and her perceptual reasoning was deficient. He said she has a very impaired memory and that she's prone to becoming confused. In addition to that, she has low self-esteem, fears rejection, and is very passive. She had few social relationships, was terrified that Ray was going to leave her, and was pathologically dependent on him. He said she meets the criteria for anxiety and dependent personality disorders. Rather than dealing with any issues, she would deny and avoid them. But, he said, he does not believe that she has an antisocial personality disorder. Dr. Howard Kay is a pediatrician who testified that he examined the medical records of the 3-year-old and 5-month-old. He said the prosecution was drastically overestimating the girl's vitamin D deficiencies, that they both had a sufficient amount in their systems. He said the 3-year-old's symptoms could have been caused by autism, neglect, or a combination of the two, that it was impossible to know for sure. As for the risks associated with the living conditions inside the home, he noted that the kids would likely have normal immunity due to their ages. But under cross-examination, Dr. Kay admitted that he had never been inside the home and that he had no personal knowledge of the home's conditions or of the fact that Erica would leave the kids in the home alone for hours. Dr. Lisa Ruccio, a clinical and forensic psychologist, testified that she was called in to evaluate Erica's state of mind, along with the presence of intimate partner violence. She interviewed Erica for about 5.5 hours and also interviewed Erica's mother. She said the relationship between Erica and Ray was consistent with a pattern of intimate partner violence. She said Ray isolated Erica from her friends and family, and that he even pressured her to quit her job so he could isolate her further. She said Ray would check in with her throughout the day, and that Erica's mother had significant concerns about his controlling behavior. Erica had no access to any of the bank accounts and didn't have a car. She lived in, quote, severe domestic squalor, but wasn't aware of how bad it really was or that it posed any health risks. She thought she was a good mom to her kids, she said. The defense's last witness was Dr. Judith Edersheim, the co-founder and co-director of the Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior. Dr. Edersheim also teaches at Harvard. Dr. Edersheim told the judge that she interviewed Erica 3 times, as well as spoke with her mother and a neighbor. She said Erica depends on external supports to help her work through her daily problems. When she interviewed Erica's neighbor, the neighbor told her that Erica functioned at a very simple level and couldn't do things that most adults could do, including taking the dog out to urinate. Dr. Edersheim testified that she believes that Erica has an avoidant and dependent personality disorder, and that when someone has that and becomes dependent on someone else, they frantically then try to avoid losing that person. Erica was wholly dependent on Ray, she said, although he was psychologically abusive. She said if Ray ever found Erica outside of the house, he would get very, very angry. She also said that Ray would often call Erica names and at one point told her that he would jump off of a bridge if she had another child, that they couldn't afford it. As for Erica's ability to lie, she said there's no question that she lied to the police, but that her motivation was that she thought she was doing the right thing in order to get out of her situation. She described Erica as being in a chronic panic and said Erica had been utterly dependent on her parents and on Ray, and that she was functioning at the ability of a 12-year-old. On cross-examination, she acknowledged that Erica said Ray had never hit her and never hit the children, or threw objects at her. The prosecution presented one witness during their rebuttal, Dr. Fabian Saleh, a forensic psychiatrist from Harvard. He testified that he interviewed Erica multiple times and that he anticipated seeing some sort of major mental health disorder, but that he was surprised when he didn't. He said her thought process was consistent and logical. He said she was masterful at concealing her pregnancies, concealing the two younger children, and concealing the corpses of the three babies. He said she did this for 8 years. He said she created the fake Facebook page for Michelle, the woman she had made up, and that she had lied to police when confronted about the dead baby's remains. While she was in jail, he said Erica did well, that despite being called a child killer and a loser, she would do yoga and would laugh frequently with cellmates. He said Ray was passive and that he would reportedly retreat to the basement and smoke pot. And then he said he disagreed with the defense witnesses, that he saw nothing about her that's avoidant or dependent in nature. He said she did not suffer from a mental health disorder. In his closing arguments, the prosecutor argued that Erica was responsible for the death of at least one of the babies. He said, fecal matter throughout can spread disease, infection, illness, and even death. But in his closing arguments, Keith Halpern said that there was no evidence of a murder.
You don't find evidence of a murder. You find suffering and fear and abuse and mental illness and terrible isolation and loneliness. And you find innocent kids who were hurt by it all. Not out of meanness, not with any intent to cause harm to anyone, not with any meaningful comprehension of the harms that were being caused. And it is a tragedy for everybody involved, but it's not a murder.
When she announced her verdict, Judge Janet Kenton Walker emphasized that this is the court of law, not a court of public opinion.
This case involves a senseless, tragic story about a dysfunctional parent and her family. Regardless of how disturbing the facts surrounding this case are to the community at large and to me as a parent, I cannot take into account those feelings. As Justice Zobel so stated in the Woodward case, as a judge, I am duty-bound to ignore it. I must look only at the evidence and the defendant. Therefore, I find the Commonwealth has failed to sustain its burden in proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Murray caused the death of baby Rivera number one, and therefore I find her not guilty of the murder charge.
The judge found her not guilty of the murder charge and not guilty of the lesser-included charge of manslaughter. She also found Erica not guilty of reckless endangerment of a child. But she did find Erica guilty of 2 counts of assault and battery on a child and guilty of 2 counts of animal cruelty. Erica is due to be sentenced in July 2019. She faces up to 20 years in prison, but has already served 5. Erica's attorney told reporters that she had received mental health treatment while behind bars and that she's now a different person than she was when this first happened. Blackstone's acting police chief, Gregory Gilmore, released a statement after the verdict was announced. Quote, on behalf of the dedicated men and women of the Blackstone Police Department who worked on this incredibly complex, disturbing, and difficult case over the past 5 years, I would like to express my appreciation to the District Attorney Joseph D. Early Jr.'s office. This was a challenging case from the very beginning, but it has been most difficult for the children involved in this horrific situation. We also hope that with the end of this case, our community, which was shocked to the very core, can find closure. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think. Do you believe Erica Murray is mentally ill? What are your thoughts on the verdict? And what is your prediction for her sentencing? Let me know by joining the discussion on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.